Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
And good evening, everyone. Welcome to another Tuesday night installment here at Your Remedies in the Law. Tonight, of course, we're discussing various IRS administrative remedies with our speaker, Mr. Tony Davis. My name is Martin Michaels. I'll be your host for this evening's conference brought to you by Your Remedies in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer. Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you are on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very politely ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedies in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. Should you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. It's just folks saying what they might do where they're similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions nonetheless, and it's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I'd like to go over a few things here with Your Remedies in the Law, if I could, very quickly. First of all, if I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremediesinthelaw.com. If we look up in the upper right-hand corner, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up with just two items on it. These two items are of much importance, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure. Better known to some as American jurisprudence or AMJUR, the rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic understanding of what's going on in virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, mostly known for its high national win rate in most traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that is not really why it's on this page. The reason that we have it up here with the jurisdictionary course is when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes a lot of the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course. So it kind of acts as a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate and traffic scenarios being such a common interest in this country today. The common law default, although known majorly for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Both of these items are very affordably priced. The jurisdictionary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of Your Remedies in the Law, most of you are probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of yourremediesinthelaw.com, you are met with that blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the site that you were visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups at Your Remedies in the Law. And Your Remedies in the Law is just one of a couple dozen websites that altogether make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, get a hold of us at yourremediesinthelaw.com, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. Statewide communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables folks to speak with one another on a local level based on a very strict predecided topics of discussion. Essentially, how it works is this. A wizard will walk you through a very easy setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. Put your zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. Then it will walk you through the remainder of the setup. And then you get to a point where it will ask you, what are your hot points interested in? This could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, or maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights, anything that you can think of. But if it affects your personal rights, you should find it in that list or something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together, much of how you think of a social network. Though nothing like a social network. It's very custom. It's very private. But it then puts you in contact with people in your local area that have similar interests to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man. If you are in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a way, a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that were like-minded, maybe you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. First person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think that they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's probably not going to be a tremendous amount of help to you. Maybe the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do were I similarly situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and then I'd go down there to my local county courthouse, go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look at these terms. Maybe the next person after that says, those all sound like great ideas. I'd also go to this particular website and check out these educational materials that might assist you in your learning. And then for you to go and do some due diligence on what you're reading, just people's suggestions, people's opinions at all. But if you did some due diligence and educated yourself, maybe the farther you got into it, you discovered that it's not as difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. And you get to the point where you've educated yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. And that's all we're trying to do here at Statewide Communications is just very simply get people to start talking again. Of course, there's no cost to you for using Statewide Communications, either signing up or the regular using of it. And so we hope that you'll pass that around. Freedoms Radio. If you're over the road, you don't want to deal with the call process, and you're just new to your remedies in the law, and you don't yet have your username and password, therefore you can't see the phone number and the PIN. By the way, if you'd like to pick up a membership to your remedies in the law, it's very easy. You just simply click the register button. Fill out your basic information there. You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate it. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your credit card or your PayPal. But every single call is recorded. You have years of archives to go through, a vast wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night, the calls go out over the air at 9 p.m. Eastern live. There's also the question bar there where you can type in a question, click submit. As long as that's during call hours, that will pop up on the moderator screen, and we do our best to read every single one of those questions out over the air, as long as they are appropriate. So you don't get the one-on-one with the information provider like you would be by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. There's no cost to utilize Freedoms Radio, so no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor, or your buyer beware. For any purchase that you may make, if your remedy is in the law or any of the other sites underneath the umbrella of Americans Restoring America, when you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you are doing just that. Information providers pay Mr. Edward for advertising at your remedy is in the law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with any other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that honestly most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. Can we make those introductions? Not every part on the information provider is always going to be successful. everybody always hopes for the best. We plan for the best, and believe you me, we aim for the best. But unavoidable things do sometimes happen, and when they do, you have to roll with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. But we also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have to say about these products and services. Now, let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not if the remedy is in the law, anyway. Of course, when you come aboard and you go with a particular information provider, again, that is exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or a credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider, and even then, that's very few and far between. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right, lastly, pertaining here to all of the information providers at Your Remedies in the Law, we'd like you to remind everybody that all of our speakers at these conferences are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always be civil. Besides, if we can dispose properly and then answer properly, then we can all learn something from it.
Well, thank you so very, very much, Martin. I appreciate that disclaimer. It's always appreciated. Thank you, sir. Tonight's topic is going to be, how important is what I own? A subtitle for this is, what is the acid test of ownership? It's going to be an interesting call tonight. In fact, I encourage you to buckle up. Without further ado, it's my pleasure to turn this call over to Brother John.
Good evening, Michael and Martin. Thank you for that kind and gracious introduction. Some of us are typical macho American males with an ego four lane freeway wide, and what we own is sometimes we live our life with the adage that he who has the most toys wins, or he who finishes with the most toys wins. But that's not always a good policy. The thing that's very important for us is that when we look back then Senator Ted Kennedy back in late the evening of July 18th, 1969, when his car veered off the road, and Miss Mary Jo Crechton passed away in the accident. He disappeared for quite a few hours, until the following morning of the 19th. And what happened was that the young 20-year-old lady, they had by then had removed the body from the vehicle, and the newspapers began to go ballistic with what had happened, and the fact that after leaving the roadway off a narrow bridge, ended up in a tidal pond, and how he got away, but the young lady didn't. And how he managed to walk away without saving her became a huge topic of discussion. And the ambulance chasers and the vultures began to surround. I mean, the lawyers and the news media began to circle around, just like Karen birds around the meat. Something that nobody realized what had happened was that in those hours that Ted Kennedy had disappeared, he completely divested himself of anything and everything that he owned, to the point where the following morning, the registration, it was the strangest thing when they Department of Motor Vehicles opened up on Monday, he didn't even own that car anymore. And so what happened was that eventually in the ensuing days and weeks, the vultures and the Karen birds and the ambulance chasers, I mean the attorneys and the newspapers, when they found out that he didn't own anything, there was nothing to go after, all of the accusations, it was the strangest thing. The publicity died as well, along with the attorney's interest. One might almost conclude that some of the attorneys involved may have had some interest in the newspapers or may have even been helping excite that. Well, what happened was that through the night, he legally divested himself of everything, and the Kennedy family, who, when they had never lost an election any time that they had put their name on a ballot, especially not in that state, there were people that were less than pleased with them and considered them political adversaries. And to that end, regardless of what their political ideologies were, they had opponents and counterparts that were less than pleased with them. And when they realized that there was nothing they could do financially to come after Ted or the family, and the fact that any assets that Ted had were completely gone or disappeared, the ones that they suspected were his, it turns out on Monday morning, weren't his. They were all somebody else's, including the vehicle. The efforts to not just go after him, but publicize what he had done, or even go after them on behalf of, and some people use the term hang him or have him lynched in effigy. All of that went away. And it was interesting that it all had something to do with just how much assets he had or owned. It raises the question, if somebody is an ambulance chaser and you're the topic of a scheme for them to get rich, and all of a sudden they discover you have no assets, it's like, holy broken tree feathers, Batman. Why are we trying to go bleed a turnip? And this turnip has no blood in it all. Let's go somewhere else. I had a situation where somebody, we were doing a benefit at a not-for-profit fundraiser for colon cancer that was had been in the media for many, many years. And my wife and son and I, we were doing tech support for them for, and we'd show up with this big trailer full of equipment, and we'd produce, and we'd move into a park where there was nothing, or actually just a grassy knoll, and produce everything, and, come up with, booths and all this stuff, and a lot of it. Apparently, unbeknownst to us, somebody deemed that we were the money behind all of everything that was going on. And our usual assets and outlays, including gas for the van, amounted to about $430 some odd. And the last 3 or 4 years that we had done it, we barely scraped by and on making it. But on the way home, towing the trailer, this Bump and Sue group, driven by one black lady, having two adult males and an adolescent adult male in the car and an infant male, toddler, went and tried to hit our vehicle multiple times. And they ended up we evaded and avoided them 4 times, and finally the 5th time the front right bumper, their left rear tire rubbed up against it, jiggled the vehicle. And so I, after slamming on the brakes 3 times in traffic, almost jackknifing the the trailer that we were towing and everything. She funny tagged us, and people saw her, you know, tagging. But what happened was is that apparently they had already been part of many, many lawsuits where they had gotten doctor's examinations from, and it was strange because in 3 of the 10 lawsuits, all 4 doctors that treated the 5 individuals were all the same name. And, you know, that provided the depositions and testimony and the medical stuff. So this is a well-established ring. And I'm speaking from personal experience. I'm not talking about something that somebody told me or something that related secondhand or thirdhand. We found out that they gave up on us. The one gentleman, when they were all arrested, when they were supposed to appear in court, one of the sheriff deputies commented that, or said that one of the defendants had, in the criminal prosecution, which technically I wasn't really part of, had commented as, and he said that the defendant made this on the witness stand. Why would we want to go after that guy? He's a turnip. And the prosecutor asked, what do you mean by turnip? He doesn't own anything. He isn't, why, you know, if you say we're a ring, why would we go after him? He's a turnip. Which begs the question, how did he know I didn't own anything? How did he know I was a turnip without assets? It's, they very carefully examined who they were going after. They had done research in advance. They apparently had picked us out 3.5 years before this event to come after. But there were some misunderstandings and misperceptions, and there were some things kind of strange that in that last few months before this event occurred, we had transferred some of our assets into a charitable religious trust and our corporation sold. We had a corp sold for many, many years. In fact, the one that we were currently using at the time, Justice Brashears helped us out with. I thought I knew what I was doing in the 90s. I thought I was very good at it. And there were people who said I was very good at it. Talk about stroking your typical macho American male ego. You know, they stroked it and they said, oh, you're doing good. This is great. And when, I met Justice Brashears in the 90s, I thought, whoa, I don't know anything about charitable religious trusts or corp souls. I was, compared to what Justice Brashears knew, I was, if my corp soul IQ would have been 2 points lower, I'd have been like a tree or a doorknob or a box of rocks or a cannoli or something. And, we, invited Justice Brashears to do, he was invited to Houston to, on multiple occasions and did multiple conferences and seminars here. And, I realized that, he was very good at it and had been doing it pretty much most of his life. I was a novice. It was only one of many things I was doing. I decided I'm going to leave this to the expert. But, what happened was is that we found out that, there's a handful of people that in the past had tried to come after us that over the years we realized that because of the way our assets were poised, they didn't really seem to care about us anymore. And, you know, they removed us from their list of targets. We had somebody that was a leader of a ring of, slip and fall lawsuit entities that used to go into shopping stores and shopping and malls and stuff. And they would literally let somebody else spill their Coca-Cola and they would come up and slip on it. And a couple times they accidentally boo-booed themselves so bad that, one of the girls knocked herself unconscious and one of the guys knocked himself unconscious, you know, and so they actually had genuine injuries, you know, and they were transported to the hospital in non-responsive state. And it wasn't until carefully examining the store cameras in this one store where they did it exactly in a blind spot so that apparently they had had it, the girl, one of the girls had asked the store, can I use your bathroom? I got to go really bad. Well, there's one just right down the cup. No, I got to go now. Can I, you know, and they let her use the bathroom. She in the back room saw the monitors and saw the blind spots and they picked out the blind spot, the hole, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Planned it down to the nth key. What happened was, is they had no idea that this child, a 4-year old in a stroller, was playing with a kid's toy that had a camera on it. And it fully recorded them spilling, doing the can of soda spill and everything. And the person looked both ways before he stepped in it, you know, left his tennis shoe print on it, and then fell. Okay. What happened was the lady that ran the shop, she wasn't really the target. Her husband, the husband of the lady that leased the space in the mall, was very wealthy. Of all things, he had a law practice. But his law practice was maritime law. It wasn't slip and fall. And, they were going after his assets. His law practice was, he owned a very large 4-story building that, was 62,000 square foot. There was 15,000 some odd feet on each of the 4 floors. His practice was on the first floor. All the others were rental. Okay. And, they were going after, this gentleman was, even though he was an attorney, he was unskillfully poised, but they made a target of him. And it's kind of strange because literally 3 days after the slip and fall, a lawsuit with all of his assets were listed as being the fact that he was aware that he was a co-signer on the lease and he was aware of the slick nature of the tile in the floor, that any liquid, and these are almost exact words from the lawsuit, that any liquid would have precipitated a slippery environment that was dangerous and hazardous to the consumer public. And they filed this before the lady who was the mother of the little girl that had the children's play toy that had recorded everything came forward with the recording and says, hey, my daughter accidentally got this. Would you like this? oops, holy broken tree feathers, Batman. it was not a very pretty thing. Those of us who are typical macho American males with a ego of 4-lane freeway wide are very pleased and excited to say, look what I have done or look what I've owned. I've pulled myself up by my own bootstraps. Horse feathers. I've got a shocking revelation for everyone. And we're going to cover that in a few moments. But a lot of people have built up huge properties. Most of the entertainment industry has started to migrate toward not owning things, but a large portion of them still do. And you go look at the Ronald Reagan Ranch in California, or Clint Eastwood's palatial estate in Southern California, or even the old Lawrence Welk estate down off the 15 East in Southern California, or many of the other, like Andy Griffith's estate, you'll find that there, even though it's called Andy Griffith, you know, Griffith's property, or Ronald Reagan's property, what's happening is that you find out that the family doesn't own any of it. They're all held by non-inorganic entities, And so if something happened, and the thing is that it's not all held by the same entity, because if this vehicle is owned by this entity and has a car accident, everything owned by that entity can now potentially be subject to and made the point of a lawsuit for damages, and including all the assets. And I've sat in rooms where attorneys literally they took the week's calls and interviews from the previous week, and they would literally go over them one by one and determine, do an initial analysis of what the assets were, of what they were worth going over. And I'm not saying that one of the retired judges who was one of my professors actually invited myself and four other students in his class to a brainstorming session like this back in 1980, in February of 80, that where they actually took 14 cases from that had potentially come in from the previous week, did an initial analysis, and determined that eight of them weren't worth following up, and the other six, they wanted to know what kind of assets everybody that was involved had, and then later determined decided on taking the case based on the assets. I'm not saying that that actually happened, and I'm not saying that it happened actually many times, and I'm not saying that a different retired judge who was also a university professor invited me to personally, and one other person, to a corporate meeting where they were determining who they could go after and sue based on what their assets were that they could seize and their assets to defend against that. And the assets that by having identified the assets in advance, they would have them frozen so they could not even use them for their own defense, but that they could take them after. I'm not saying any of that ever happened, but you can make your own decisions on that. But one thing that I've learned, that I might have learned, is that if you have assets, there's somebody that out there, no matter what you think, there may be somebody, an entrepreneur out there, whether it's an individual or even a state agency that is looking to come after your assets. A license is permission to do something that's otherwise illegal. In certain cases, people could not be joined without a license, if you will. And the case in point on this were slaves. But when the property of one plantation was allowed to be joined to another property of another plantation, so the plantation owners, strong adversaries, could not come together and get into an argument over it, the product of that union was property of the state. That's why when you have children and you have a marriage license and birth certificates, that's why Child Protective Services has jurisdiction over that child. When you look back in the marriages and deaths and births were all when the days when they were recorded in the family Bible with two witnesses, and even before that, they're recorded by a church clergy and two witnesses. What happens is that, ask yourself, why do you need or why do you want a marriage license? Because now when you die also, the state has the right to probate. They get one, they have the right to argue for one third of the assets, your assets. Okay. Now, if you don't own anything, they can't come after anything. We've just recently in the last couple of years have been over multiple cases where something somehow ended up in probate and, when an individual died and, the property was, property of a charitable religious trust. Even though the individual himself, the widow, was still making the payments on the, or should have been making the payments on the loan, The property had already been transferred under something called 12 U.S.C. 1701 J3 8 or D8, the Garn St. Germain Act, and in with which you can transfer property into a trust as long as you are still the legal beneficiary and it does not change the occupancy, meaning that you don't, there's not somebody else going to become an occupant of that property just because you changed the trust, meaning it's not for income. So what happens is that this probate action, and it turns out that it was, this particular case was one of our students. This wonderful sweet widow lives out west, and dear, precious sweet widow. And they were, the probate court was having fits over this thing and over her property. They want, you know, they wanted to probate the property after her husband passed. And when we pointed out that it was not her property and it wasn't the husband's property at the time of passing, that it was significantly long before that that he had donated to a charitable religious trust. They happened to be living there. It was transferred under the Garn St. Germain Act of 1982, which Ronald Reagan signed into office in February of 1982. But the property was legally transferred long before he passed. This wasn't a Ted Kennedy moment after driving away from the Chappaquiddick, committing a boo-boo that evening, and then before the next morning, quick transferring everything. They now, most states have laws, and two states even call it the Ted Kennedy Law. Well, not officially, but most of the jurists and most of the attorneys there, and New York is not one of those states, so don't think that for a second. But the, what happens is that, they now have, if it was transferred within a certain amount of time of the, difficulty, they say that was in preparation or planning for, the potential event. And so they void the, transfer. Excuse me. But what's happening is that if you are a beneficiary of a trust and the property is owned by the trust and you're living there, maybe you, the sweat of your brow and the, you know, the toil and the sweat of your hands, took a vacant piece of land and tilled the soil and turned it up and seeded and fertilized it and you put a foundation and built a house on it. You spent your life's blood doing that, and all of a sudden you pass away, and the state wants a piece of that action. Your wife gets some, and then the children get what's left over. But if it's not owned by you, if you are free to donate and give away to the trust, or to charitable religious trust or corporation soul, all the assets therein, and not cling to them with our meaty, greedy hands, then what happens is that when you pass away, you didn't own anything. There wasn't of any significance. There isn't any point in having a probate hearing where mom's still living or dad's still living, whichever one is surviving. Ends up, they still live there. The state of California tried to come over after my personal family, my father and my family, and back in 1979, we set up a trust for a non-revocable trust for the family, non-revocable charitable religious trust, and they had actually come to the place where they were trying to ask my brother, who's caring for my dying father, they wanted them out of the properties, because they were getting ready to sell it. We made it clear to them that mom and dad had nothing to do with the property, and that many, many years earlier, out of the graciousness of their hearts, they donated it to a charitable religious trust. It's now, the trust back then was could only be marginally called a charitable religious trust under the current definition that Justice Breshears uses. He truly creates charitable religious trust at an unbelievable level and an unbelievable scale. And what happens is that the genuineness of them, it's not the fictitious unit that or entity that is there just for personal gain. It's evident that it is a charitable religious trust, and it's been established for the correct reasons. At this juncture, what happened was that all of a sudden the state used the word, the O word. Oops. We thought, oh, well, thank you for trying to do a good job, but this may not be the best place to give your attention. There's nothing here. We were kind about it, and they actually laughed as they left, and they were, you know, and we gained some unbelievable apologies from people, and it turned into an event where we were able to actually endear ourselves to some very significant political placed individuals that now are good friends of the family and are actually looking out for my surviving aged father's interest in a very positive manner. And I have a brother who practices. He's a senior resident for CCICU for Los Angeles County UCLA Medical Center downtown. And previously there was a difficulty about the county commissioner wanted to give everybody the jab, demanded everybody have the jab. And my brother may have been a dissenter on that and got into a few tiffs with it. Well, these individuals, when we were kindly and considerate with them, all of a sudden, some of them, we had no idea that they spoke up and had kind of quietly quashed some of the, not just for my brother individually, but for all the medical professionals at County UCA Medical. They may have quietly reduced the pressure that was coming to bear about getting the CV-19 jab. And it was all because somebody didn't want to have to, or didn't, not just didn't want to have to deal with the perils of ownership, but was willing to not deal with their own ego on the ownership. And some people say, well, John, I do want to own it. I absolutely, you know, and one friend, he has a 1977 Ferrari 308 GTSI, very rare, in pristine condition. It's only got 1,400 original miles on it. And that's his pride and joy. And have I ridden in it? Yeah. Did I ride in it in the 70s? Oh, yeah. Short distances, with only 1,400 original miles on it. You can tell it hadn't gone very far. But he prides himself in that vehicle. His father passed away recently. Bob owned four vintage Rolls Royces, some people love that joke, Sean Connery cracks when he's talking to, Mr. Orrick Goldfinger, and he says, fabulous car. It's a Phantom 3, model, your model 37. And, Bob owned a Phantom 3, year model 37. Prided himself in it, you know, because it was the same one that was literally two cylinder numbers away from the one that was used in the James Bond movie. And, when Bob passed away, that ended up being sold at auction. And, most of the proceeds ended up being the probate tax, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I asked the question, why in this green earth would you really truly want to own something of that value yourself? And most people don't realize, you know, it's not actually even possible. Some people say, well, John, how could that possibly be possible or impossible? Well, that's a good question. I'm glad you asked. If I was to ask each and every one of you on this call this evening, each one in the listening audience, to look right now And you can decide whether this is a rhetorical question or non-rhetorical question. But I want each one of you, every one of you right now, to pick out something that you believe you own. And I'm going to give you a few moments to think about it, whether it's your watch or your car or your house. But I want each and every one of you to think about this question, okay? What do you, I want one thing, not a long list, just one thing. Think about, and maybe even point to one thing that you own right now. And I'm going to give you a few seconds. Now that everybody's taken a moment to think about something that they own, now we're going to apply the acid test of ownership. There are a few of you out there who know what the acid test of ownership is, and you've probably heard this before. Well, I'm going to reiterate it for both the those that do know it and those that don't, to provide a consideration for those who don't, and hoping not taking for granted those of you who already know it. But the acid test of ownership is this, or is the following question, okay? And these are the guidelines to prove whether you really own something or you don't. Everybody ready? Buckle up, Spanky. This one's coming from downtown. Here's the test. If you either bought it with you when you came to this rock, or you can take it with you when you leave, then you the man, or you the woman, and you the owner. You know, you truly are the holder of the goods. But if you didn't either bring it with you when you came to this rock, or you can't take it with you when you leave, then it begs the question, who is the owner? And for some of you, you'll know, you know, this reference instantaneously. Is that the guy that owns the sheep and the cattle on 1,000 hills and all the gold and silver therein? And many of you already recognize the reference and where it came from. But it's the fact that that intelligent designer that made this rock, you know, he's probably the only one that qualifies as an owner. So what does that make us? Custodians? Trustees? You know, stewards? We're somebody that's taking care of the assets that belong to someone else. And if that really is the case, and we do a good job of that, that someone else may be very happy with us. If we're somebody that prides ourselves in us because they're in our possession at the moment, we like to claim that they're ours, I wonder, you just have to ask yourself the question, if using the acid test of ownership, I wonder how, if that other, that intelligent designer out there is the one that really owns it, how does he feel about our attitude? Does he consider us egotistical and a little bit out of control and a little arrogant? I don't know if he would think that we're being kind and benevolent when he's the owner, and if you realize that he's the owner of everything, you have to ask yourself the question. So, that means I'm in possession of this out of his kindness and his graciousness? Yeah. And I'll tell you something. A few years back, you know, we used to be a two airplane family. We had the little compact Cessna 150 economy car, you know, economy airplane. Fly from Houston to Dallas in less than 78 minutes. And the little airplane with 55% power, flew 84 miles an hour. And when you're going direct line cross country, we would land in Dallas Love Field in less than 90 minutes, you know, in that little two seat Cessna 150. And we also had a family car, the Rockwell Twin Commander 680 straight. With the pilot, co-pilot, 7-passenger, you know, is really, kind of a nice aircraft. There was a little fire and spread to our home, our hangar. And if you want to know what we had, just ask Justice Brashear sometime. He came to stay with us, multiple times. He and back then wife, who's now deceased, bless her heart. She's with the Most High King now. But, they came and they stayed in our hangar, but we were using it. They parked their camper inside our hangar, and we had the honor and the privilege of the presence of their presence for many, many times. But there was a fire, and it took everything. And if you look at the address, you know, that for our place, it's a smoldering, it still looks like a smoldering crater. There's a stale image on Google Earth there, but it, you can tell it looked like a bomb went off or a fire. You know, you can tell there was a fire there. In many places, the metal wasn't just the paint peeled off of it or burned off it, not just the metal softened, not just the metal melted, but the metal was incinerated. There was portions of pallet racks. We had 480 linear feet of anywhere from 10 to 16 foot high pallet racks. We had four forklifts. We had multiple airplanes in the hangar. You probably figured out it wasn't a small hangar. It was equivalent to a 32 car garage. We had a little 8,000 square foot hangar with a 2,900 square foot office building and residence attached to it. But there was places where on the lathe and the mill that whole sections of the machines were completely incinerated. There wasn't a puddle of metal on the ground. It was completely incinerated. The devastation was unbelievably total. It was just melted or softened metal. That was all that was left. There was a pantry that we kept food and groceries and stuff for emergencies, because we regularly have these wild, crazy meteorological entertainers that come to town here, like Hurricane Rita and Hurricane Katrina. Those were both real party animals. And, I and seven other men and my son John Arthur set up a hurricane shelter, that we originally scheduled the population for, 800 people. And, a week before the, Hurricane Rita hit, the population doubled. 4 days before Rita hit, Judge Eccles closed all the ARC shelters, and our population doubled again. And 2 days before, our population doubled again. Well, we had collected foodstuffs in 5 and 6 gallon buckets, but somehow the fire didn't get through all of that, but it got through everything else. You know, and when we got the call that our place was on fire, we were driving up to a local lake here in the Texas area. We were getting ready to build a give back project for Boy Scouting, a Boy Scout ski base. We were driving the permit route to take a 32 foot by 16 foot barge up there for doing teaching sailing and canoeing and kayaking and swimming, etc. And we had to drive the permit route by the instructions from the state. We had to drive it within 72 hours of doing that. It was a day before Memorial Day, 2015. And if you look up Hooks Airport Fire 2015, you'll see what happened to us. In fact, you can see the barge sitting up front. You know, you can see what was left of our hangar very, very quickly. But as we turned around and we're driving back, we talked about the acid test of ownership. And when we realized that we did not own anything and that it all belonged to the king, we got here and we had a very different attitude about the loss. We had just helped somebody else 8 years earlier get over the loss of their hangar and fire, and they were still very bitter. In fact, one man's, his exact words were, "How could a good God, who's my wife and my son both serve, do this to me?" And I'm thinking, is there somebody missing out of that? Is there a factor missing out of that equation? Did you just, you know, but what happened was is that one lady says, you know, look at what's happened to you. You've lost everything. And she was crying, you know, talking to my son. And my son turned around, looked at her and says, "You know, ma'am, it's just possessions." She calls me up 3 weeks later and says, "Is everything all right with your son?" I says, "What do you mean?" Well, Bouncer says, what do you mean? He says, well, I was telling you how bad I felt for you guys losing everything. And, you know, it was like a $5.8 million loss. And, you know, that's where the fire marshal quit tabulating when he found out the insurance company wasn't going to pay. That included a couple of airplanes, video production studio, all kinds of electronics labs, you know, a legal law library that had $750,000 worth of books in it, and, you know, just all kinds of stuff. And I says, you mean, is he like three French fries short of a Happy Meal? And she says, yeah. You know what? And the take that once we realized the difference between what we really owned and what we didn't, it allowed us to, some freedom from bitterness that just you couldn't imagine. And what's even much better is that one of our neighbors, who is an absolute, unbelievable, abominable, litigious, his wife broke her heel in the automated door track at a Safeway supermarket, broke her stiletto heel, and sued for $500,000 and got it. His hanger had debris soot over it, and there was a teeny bit of discoloration from the fire of our hanger. Inside the fire, there was recorded temperatures, but with an optical pyrometer or interferometer by the deputy fire chief of the local fire department, of in excess of 3400 degrees, 3400 degrees. That was so hot in there that nothing could survive. What used to be on the outside, a 32 and a half to almost 33 feet high parapet, was now only 6.5 feet high. Okay. The top of the hangar in some places. He decided not to sue us, for the damage to his, you know, when he found out we didn't have any assets. How important is what you think you own versus what you actually own? And when you ask yourself, what do I actually own? Ask yourself, any in your family, what are we doing hanging on to it? And if you can be benevolent enough to donate it to a charitable religious trust in which you are the beneficiary, and where, regardless of whatever happens, there's a chance, even your demise, that your family may still possess what you worked so hard for, or even your predecessors worked for, your parents. And the thing is that when it's donated to a charitable religious trust, and they technically qualify under Chapter 508, and I say 508, not 501c3, but 501c3, you can do that too, then the land, most jurisdictions allow you to not be taxed. The property tax continues to levy on those of us who are selfish enough to keep it in our own possession. And yes, we have individuals on this call that have been seeking to work on their property taxes, and that one of the ways in dealing with your property tax, there's many ways to deal with it. A title in allodium that traces, and when I say in allodium, meaning that you've actually traced it back to an original land grant, where, in this case, allodial title is not a function of something that is where the property owner is the highest taxing entity or authority. Title in allodium is that, meaning you've traced it back to its original title. And remember, this America, before the 1400s, was not populated by anybody but American Indians, who were the descendants of those that had worked this land for the purpose of mining resources for Solomon's temple. And the Egyptians, and the reason why the temples in Central and South America and the pyramids match that which is in Africa and Israel, is because many of those slaves and many of the people who came over here, it says, and Pharaoh gave his daughter to Solomon for a wife until such time as the temple and the palace were built. He had access to all those Egyptian slaves, and they were over here on Phoenician trading ships, And so before that, before we got here, all these descendants all came from there. And after the French, the Spanish, and the English, and et cetera, all got into these different arguments over who would own the property and who would own the new America, eventually they started giving title to individuals that they thought would lend favor to them that could hold their rights and uphold their rights for them if they gave them substantial quantities of land that they'd be willing to die for it. That was the king's, and to that end, they gave them the right that they were the highest taxing authority in that. And so that, yeah, they made it a juicy tidbit to be able to go after a morsel that was enticingly, unignorably delectable. Then there's taxation that, a third area that in the Bill of Rights, you have inalienable rights established by the Creator. There's multiple ways that in multiple jurisdictions that we've addressed that. But one of the easiest ways to deal with it is the fact that if we decide and we reconcile who really owns the property and then work with him, the one with a capital H, on his with a capital H basis, it makes things a whole lot easier. So how important is what you own versus what you know you don't actually own? And with that, I have to apologize. I've already gone over a minute. Tonight's subject matter topic, we're opening up for question and answers. You do not have to, adhere to the subject matter topic. You can, field a question on any subject matter you please. If you choose to adhere to the subject matter topic, that lends some consistency and consistency and coherence to the evening. That's great. But if you don't, that's also great. It's our honor and privilege to serve you and serve your questions. With that, back to you, Michael and Martin.
Well, thank you, John. I appreciate that very much. Ladies and gentlemen, I want to support something that when John said it, I went and looked for it, regarding how the Child Protection Services, how they can just come in and swoop up your children and take them into custody and all that other good stuff. In 1905, Wadley versus Newell, it's the Circuit Court of North District of California, okay, even back then. Quote, civil rights under the 14th Amendment are for federal citizens and not state citizens. Federal citizens, as parents, have no right to the custody of their infant children except subject to the paramount right of the state. End quote. Isn't that just ducky? All right, press star 2 on your keypad, ladies and gentlemen, to raise your hand. Press star 2. Those of you on Freedoms Radio, you'll see to the center right of your monitor a silhouette of a rectangle laying on its side. Left-click inside of it. Type away your comment or your question. Underneath, you'll find a place to put your name and some other information. Hit submit, and then it'll pop up on my end. When it pops up on my end, I'll give voice to your comment or your question. We start with Kent and then go to Ron. Go ahead, Kent.
Okay. Good evening, gentlemen. Can you hear me okay?
Yes. Thank you, Kent.
Okay.
How are you doing this evening, Kent?
Pretty good. As well as I presume you're doing.
Oh, shucks, Ma.
Can I make that presumption?
Yeah, absolutely, Kent. Did I tell you how much fun I'm really having today?
No, tell us again.
I had an outpatient unscheduled surgical procedure yesterday. My pain level is about an 8.5. And to keep my wits about me, I'm not taking any pain medication, so that I can keep my wits about me for all of you. And to that end, I also have a migraine that started yesterday just before the surgery. and I have not been able to shake it. And I am in the whole house. There's only a couple lights on because I'm photosensitive right now. So I am having more fun than a mortal human being should be mortally allowed to have.
Well, I better clarify this then before I ask you any questions. Even though you're not taking any drugs, will the migraine possibly adversely affect any answer you might provide?
You mean, am I going to chew your head off just because I think, you know, you're accusing me of some crime that you didn't commit?
Well, okay.
So, hey, listen, a misperception on my part never constitutes wrongdoing on your part, and I'll try not to bite your head off.
Okay. So I have a couple of issues to raise about the topic of the evening, but before I do that, last night on the call, it was spoken of regarding a case that's going to be filed within the next week or so regarding a recalcitrant prosecutor that is moving ahead with a case on an American national. Could you comment on that case for us, and then I'll go to my other questions?
I'm going to leave that to GW right now. With your permission, I would like to leave that one alone. There's a couple reasons. My plate has been very busy, very heavily scheduled, and I wish I could say I was certain I could do justice to it. If I had known about it in advance, I would have studied up, but it would be unskillful for me to attempt to answer it tonight.
Okay. Well, just so the record is set, so to speak, last night it was said on GW's call that you would be the one to comment on this, not anybody else.
Yeah, I don't think John knows what we're talking about here.
Yeah, we had the classic clerk in the bank moment. Oh, gee, sir,
yeah.
You have a weapon. You want to talk to that guy over there?
Yeah, John, what we're talking about here, remember the father and son, both students of yours. The son that's who we're talking about. And I had said on the call last night when we were segueing into that the next step is going to be to deal with the deprivation of rights under color of law by the Leo and the prosecutor anyways.
Okay.
Or did I speak out of turn?
I thought we were talking about something else. Okay.
That's what I thought.
Thank you for clarifying that. Kent, in that case, I will comment.
Okay.
Kent, by way of asking a few questions, are you ready?
I'm ready. And then I also want to know from you, what should we be asking GW so that he can fill us in on what you are unable to next Monday?
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Wait a minute. Kent, John made that comment based upon a misperception of what we're talking about.
Oh, I thought he's talking about another case that he wants GW to elaborate on.
I thought that you were referring to a case that's occurring on a complete opposite side of the United States that was just brought to my attention, and I hadn't studied up on that. I didn't realize that the case you were asking about is the one that I am currently working very hard on.
Okay.
Does that help just a little?
Yeah, that helps. Okay.
Okay. Okay. Here's what's happening. Okay, and you can apply these questions across the board, but let me ask you a question. Just because a person is elected to a position, does that make them immune from prosecution to criminal acts that they may commit?
No.
Follow me on this. Let's suppose we take that to the case of an elected senator or elected representative. Let's suppose that they conspire to deprive you of your civil rights under color of law by passing a law that says maybe you can only have a 10-round magazine in that gun when the Constitution and the Bill of Rights provide for inalienable rights or unalienable rights, in this case, the right to keep and bear an arm without infringement. But they're infringing upon it. But just because they're elected to office, does that make them immune from prosecution?
Well, I told you no, but I guess in today's world,
okay.
Your answer is
correct, and we're gonna keep building on this. We're gonna take it a little farther. Does that also make them immune from arrest?
No.
Okay. So if you complain of somebody who committed an act, maybe it's a few years ago, but there's no statute limitation on legislating criminal conspiracy to deprive you of your rights. At least not yet, there's not. Now that I've been bringing it up, there probably will be pretty soon because there's a few. I was on a conference call yesterday with some legislators from a state out east that they were scared kittens about that, and they were considering changing their stance on constitutional carry in their state. I had someone call me from a lady's one of her aides called me that she wanted to know about some of the legislation that her boss had worked on or passed or even promoted, not just promoted but authored over the years of her service, and asked about the for visibility for criminal prosecution or civil prosecution. And I asked her, I says, just because somebody's elected to office, does that make them immune for prosecution? And she says, there's certain states and there's certain U.S. appellate court and Supreme Court decisions that say that judiciary and prosecutors have prosecutorial immunity and judicial immunity. And I asked her, I said, so what, and I need to ask you this question, ma'am. I says, you know, they're talking about, and she says, so immunity does exist. And I says, so you're saying that a judiciary can just wash away somebody's civil rights under color of law or their local court, et cetera, and not be liable, and or they can commit high crimes and misdemeanors and treason, you know, and she said, well, you know, the it's very, very clear that, you know, judicial immunity, so there has to be immunity for elected officials. And she was fishing very seriously, very hard in a deep pond. And I says, ma'am, can you pull up Article 3, Section 1, Line 2 of the Constitution? She says, well, I don't have one in front of me. I says, you got your, you know, you're talking to me on your smartphone. I says, I'll pause while you, you know, just type in Article 3, Section 1, Line 2, Paragraph 1, Line 2. And she pulled it up. It says, the judges of both the superior and inferior courts shall hold their offices during times of good behavior. Holy broken tree feathers, Batman. She says, but these are Supreme Court decisions. I says, the Supreme Court does not usurp the Constitution. They can only interpret it. The Constitution can say white, and they cannot say that it says black or green. They can only enforce and support. And she goes, and I says, that in itself is a crime to say that, to hand down an opinion that is an opposite to the Constitution. According to Marbury versus Madison, Second Cranch, 1803, 579, anything repugnant to the Constitution is void. And she paused for a moment, and things went quiet for a second. I didn't realize. She told me later, I says, I'm sorry, did somebody come in the room? She goes, no, sir. I threw up. and I didn't want you to hear that on the phone. When I told her, when she realized that her boss and she realized that her boss could be liable, and she says, well, what can they do? I says, well, there's only two ways to handle this. Remove all justiciable standing that would cause her at risk of being prosecuted. She says, I didn't say it was a her. I says, I already know who you work for. You know, I looked you up on the internet. And, you know, and she goes, well, what's the other one? I says, no, you need to remove the justiciable standing. And she says, what are you saying? You got to go back and change the laws? Well, she could void, rescind her signature from every one of those. And she says, well, what's the other? I says, move to a non-extradition country. And that.
How many judges have you known have moved to those countries?
Number four just happened only about a month ago. On the first two, we asked too many questions. Some people would say it the wrong way, but I'd like to believe we asked them the right way, to where they pondered to where the Chief Justice allowed, first the magistrate judge, then the, senior justice to, step down. And when they read the brief in support of the motion, and they realized that there was no such thing as prosecutorial immunity or judicial immunity, they both of them, those first two, cashed out all their whole retirement and moved to non-extradition countries. That's not even a joke. Mr. Edwards is actually quite serious. He chuckled a little there, but there was no joke about that. But what happens is that we've been asking these individuals, when you have challenges, and people are committing wrong, do you appeal it or do you have it prosecuted? You appeal the bad behavior or do you seek prosecution? And in that particular case that GW is talking about, the young man, bless his heart, he is standing his ground. He's trying to do what's right. He's got a great heart, and I he's earned a level of respect in my heart that isn't easily earned and is very hard to get. But he and his father both, I have nothing but the greatest respect for them. And he went into court and the judge all but ruled against him. But the judge didn't all. You notice all is a very substantial word that encompasses a level of completeness that is almost only akin to to God himself. The judge says, well, I'm going to give you 30 days to work this out with the prosecutor. So we're going to sit down with the prosecutor and talk about their issues, and we're going to slowly try to educate the prosecutor. I think the judge Smelder suspects something that's upright and honorable and honest and real in this particular case. So what we're going to do is we're increasing their level of education to the point where hopefully this young man will be able to speak to the difference between the rights of an American national and a U.S. citizen completely on his own. And in the meantime, because the officer broke the rules, and the officer knows the rules, that young man did have a firearm in his car. In fact, he has more than one. And they had the ammunition. Okay, so what? Where, Your Honor, where in the Constitution does it give my right to keep a firearm in your courtroom, let alone my truck? You know, and so what's happening is that do we appeal that bad behavior, or should we have it prosecuted? What's the correct answer?
Prosecute it.
Okay. You know what? I think I'm gonna choose to agree with you. Okay. Now, what happens? Now, that was the actual act. So that would be probably seeking a grand jury indictment from a federal prosecutor, 18 U.S.C. 242, and writing the letter and with an affidavit stating the facts and making the complaint and signing it with a true bill. Okay, now, why hasn't the prosecutor dismissed those charges? Is she, in this case, it's two she's, are they conspiring to deprive this young man of his civil rights under color of law? Under 18 U.S., is that possible? That they're, because they haven't automatically dismissed it? Is it possibly that they're trying to deprive this young man of his rights? What do you think, Ken?
Of course it's possible. In fact, it looks that way.
Okay.
From the facts you provided, it would appear to be the case.
I'm inclined to agree with you. Now, let me, before we go to the next stage, I'll ask a couple more questions on this. Initially, there had to be something to go to the grand jury to get not one, not two, but all three felony grand jury indictments. And so it was probably one or both of these prosecutors that did that, right? So is that a...
I would imagine.
So would that be evidence of a deprivation of civil conspiracy to deprive somebody of their civil rights under color of law?
Yeah, if they did it willingly and knowingly when they should have known better.
Right.
If you're asking whether or not they have an affirmative defense, I don't see that they would have an affirmative defense for doing that.
Okay. You know what? And I would absolutely have to agree with you on that. And I do agree with you. Now, let's say maybe there was a chance that they weren't thinking straight, or maybe they were well-intentioned, but they made an error. They just an ignorant error that they didn't understand. So what happens is, let's bring it to their attention. Let's maybe make a motion to dismiss and put that all in the motion to dismiss. This is before they're even arraigned, before this young man is even arraigned. So we're going to put it in the motion to dismiss, and we're going to explain. And all of a sudden, they show up for the motion hearing, and they reaffirm. They not only show up for the motion hearing, but they make a response to the motion, and they set it for a hearing, and the judge reaffirms what the prosecutors were affirming. Now, so the prosecutors, the prosecutors read the motion for dismissal that had everything in it, correct? They had to, because they responded, right?
That's correct.
And then the judge had to have read all of that. So now the prosecutors can no longer feign ignorance, can they? Because it was explained to them in the motion. If it was explained to them in the motion to dismiss, and they were otherwise acting just out of the best, civic-minded intentions, now it's been explained, and they understand that it's a criminal act. And then they continue to support that, not just in a motion, but in court. Do they have any affirmative defense that you can imagine?
No, they're involved in malicious conduct.
Okay. Would the judge have read the original, indictment, the motion to dismiss, and the prosecutor's, motion to deny the motion to dismiss?
Yeah, I would think the judge would have accidentally.
Yeah, do you think the judge would have accidentally read any of those, or maybe even all of them?
Yeah, that's why I think the judge would be having a conversation with the prosecutor by now.
Yeah. So if you were going to file a motion for grand jury indictment under federal statute 18 U.S.C. 241. Deprivation of civil rights, conspiracy to deprive civil rights under color of law. The officer, he just flat out took the guns and arrested him. Okay? So that's the actual act. So that's 18 U.S.C. 242. But what happens with 18 U.S.C. 241 is that that's the conspiracy to do that. So could it be considered that the judge, having read all this, is conspiring with the prosecutor?
The answer would be yes.
So do we seek a grand jury indictment against the prosecutors and the judge? Would that be the correct approach?
Well, the fastest way to get rid of it might be just to seek the indictment against the two prosecutors, leave the judge out. The judge will then get the message for sure and want to get as far away from this as possible.
Okay. But one time in a courtroom in a galaxy far, far away, the question was begged to the judge. He says, if a federal marshal, I know you won't do that, you won't rule that way, because if a federal marshal saw that, they might consider that a federal felony deprivation of civil rights under color of law, and with which that they would, you know, they're the only ones that are tasked with the mandate to that they don't have a choice when a felony is committed. They're required by federal law to make an immediate detention, to detain the individual. She says, but there's no federal marshal here. And all of a sudden, one stands up. Not that federal marshal, the other one. And a second one stands up. Not that federal marshal, the other one. And then one of the two that you paid the $275 an hour job shopping, you know, moonlighting fees, stands up. And now there's three standing up. And then the other one that you paid for stands up, opens her jacket, says, are those guns in my courtroom? Your Honor, question, ma'am, where in the Constitution is excluded the right to keep bear a firearm in your courtroom? And, I could find you in. I says, Your Honor. And she says, does the state have a motion, Madam Prosecutor? And she goes, what? She says, does the state have a motion to dismiss all the felony charges against this elderly lady? But Your Honor, there's four, unlawful carry of a gun on the school grounds, unlawful carry of a weapon, et cetera. She says, you know what? I could just summarily dismiss this, she can walk out the courtroom. But see, then those two federal marshals over there all four of them have justiciable standing to take, to arrest you. But if the state dismisses, then they no longer have justiciable standing to take you to jail. And I think those young men over there would like to prove to their supervisors and their overseers that they're doing their work during the day, and they'd like to walk in with somebody in handcuffs. So the choice is yours. And then the other prosecutor stands up and says, Your Honor, the state moves to dismiss on all charges. So they're aware of justiciable standing.
So the judge could have done it sua sponte, but she wanted to have it the prosecutor do it, is what you're saying.
That judge, as I am told, her daughter went to law school with one of the two prosecutors.
Mm-hmm.
And they were friends, good friends. And I think she didn't want to see the prosecutor go to jail that day. So What's happening is that at this juncture, that justice realized in that moment that there was a good chance that she was about to be given some gifts, jewelry, bracelets, and a new wardrobe, orange. The color for the season, but she didn't want to have any part of it. And she was trying to be nice to the prosecutor with that, and at first she tried to kind of nudge her, and nudge them both. And they didn't. So she spelled it out for them.
Mm-hmm.
And, the federal marshal, he, after the judge left the bench, they had a hoot of a laugh. Both prosecutors slinked out of the courtroom very, very quietly. Mm-hmm. One of them had somebody come back and get her briefcase and her laptop. She was pointing to her assistant, go get my stuff. I'm not going back in there.
Mm-hmm.
So they,
now could you,
you know, go ahead.
Well, I wanted to know if you could clarify. I then want to move on to what I wanted to ask about your topic for this evening. But could you clarify something that you said? You said that with the work that you're doing, and I guess other people are doing, that you could see coming down the road, especially on the East Coast, laws that will be proposed regarding a statute of limitations on criminal conspiracies, where they're depriving you of your rights under color of law. Why would that be, other than it's another hoop that one would have to jump through, why would that be of any concern to you? Because they could pass all the laws they want as a corporate government. If you're an American national and are separated from that system, why would this be of concern to you? Let them pass whatever laws they want.
That's a good question.
Before you answer that, John, before
you
answer that, does the is fraud in the criminal activity that has been discussed thus far, is fraud also part of that criminal activity? And if so, fraud vitiates all. Fraud vitiates everything. Back to you. Just asking.
There's times where I had one case in a Florida court, U.S. District Court, that it went on for years because of the arguments in the statute over the statute of limitations, and they eventually wore out the two individuals that were trying to be exonerated, to the point where both of them ran into ill health. So, yeah, you're right. We can do the battles, but, you know, and it's only a matter of time and blood. And if you've got unlimited time and blood, hey, more power to you. But I'd rather see a reduction in the printed law and keep everything to common law. And so that it's very clear that, an individual that is not committed, these victimless crimes that are being committed, quote unquote, or in general, people are being criminalized because of a victimless crime, and their liberty is being taken away. I would rather not see the statutes enacted, save them some time and grief, and to enjoy a little bit more of the liberty in their life. That's why.
Okay, I think that's a reasonable answer. Thank you.
Okay, what was the other one on the subject?
Yeah.
You said you had one more on this. Go ahead.
Well, no, I actually had a couple more. You were talking about how people really don't own anything unless they either brought it with them when they came to this rock or they're going to take it with them. But don't you think that from the point of view that we're approaching this as American nationals and being separate from that system, or even when you look at the system as it exists today, being for the most part fictional in nature, including what passes as quote-unquote money, how is it that we really, isn't there a more fundamental question to what you're asking here? How can we really own anything? Now, I mean, I'm putting aside, you know, something that somebody may have bought with gold or silver, but the fact that most people have transacted whatever they bought, not knowing any better for the most part, with Federal Reserve notes, isn't there a more basic question here about how we can own anything?
You rock, brother. You rock. That question that I posed is a thought-provoking, is a question that I pose just to be thought-provoking at a very lowest common denominator level, so that whether people begin to understand the fallacies of ferns or all of the other travesties that are going on regarding the lies and deceptions, especially regarding the monies and the currency that are out there. That is a very, very basic thought-provoking question that helps them understand that even if they are dealing with lawful monies, we're still dealing with the figure, with who really is the asset, using the asset test of ownership, who really is the owner. And so that all the other arguments, and there are some many, many good ones out there that individuals make that regarding the fallacies of ferns, et cetera. And don't worry, it's much worse than you think. The value of the printed,
that leads me to the second part of that question, which is since the state, I'll just broadly say the state, whether it be federal or state or whatever level, municipal, county, whatever, since they have or certainly appear to have some interest in all property because of all of these other factors that we know about and we're talking about, don't you think that as far as when a case comes about and you were talking about, having to defend the case and, somebody suing you, et cetera, and protecting your assets, shouldn't we really have a way at this point in time to hook the, again, I'll use it as a broad term, the state, because they have part of the ownership of the property? Doesn't that require some more exploration rather than the presumption that, you had a piece of property and you bought an insurance policy, and so therefore you own the property and the insurance company isn't going to ask any questions, the title company isn't going to ask any questions because they're all part of that system. But isn't there really here also a bigger question about how the state becomes hooked with the liability when something goes wrong with a piece of property? And I'm not trying to be impractical when I ask this question. I'm trying to be practical about it. If you think I'm off the wall, this just gets way too technical for this conversation, then, you're welcome to tell me so and I'll drop it.
Your stocks sink, Kim. Change them. No. Keep your socks on. Many jurisdictions and states have laws regarding the fiduciary responsibility of the local and the state government and the individuals that work there. And to that end, they grant them immunity to a certain degree or even completely. And because individuals trying to serve the public trust are just trying to serve the public trust. And well-meaning individuals have got bond issues passed and everything to purchase a piece of property for an emergency services district or a firehouse or, a schoolhouse or whatever. And, so the properties that come up that now require extensive finances that extend the existing budget even more to be not just the maintenance, but populate it with qualified personnel. Those different tasks, whether they're teachers or firemen or postmen or whatever, those services need to be covered somehow. So what happens is that they now have to have public works to maintain those buildings and everything else. So what happens is that they don't consider that. They, quite the opposite, they absolve those individuals of any, and those entities of any liability, regardless of the hurt that they're inflicting. And when they're inflicting that kind of hurt or injury upon the people, to the point where the people are losing their houses, the people are supposed to be serving, that's where, the taxes are so great that now individuals are selling the property because the taxes are too high. That's where it becomes a deprivation of civil rights under color of law. And we haven't yet developed the quorum in our society yet to say, hold on, guys, this is as far as we go. There is, you know, we're just going to maintain what we have. I was at a mayor's conference about 40 years ago in which some of the egotistical hose the deck down with testosterone. I mean, it wasn't just wet on the floor. It was ankle deep because the mayors were talking about, well, my city's getting this or mine's going to get that or my police force is going to, and they were the arguments and all you could see was dollar signs and tax signs floating around the air while everyone was talking. And, it was really, really bad. They all took a lot of pride in their city, but what was happening was that they showed up at this mayor's conference and they were just making unbelievable statements and claims. And later on, I watched those cities do those very things that they were talking about and on the backs of the peoples. And, four of those cities, those mayors that were there, people are currently moving out of those cities. There was somebody showed me a newspaper article a while back that says, has this percentage of this city actually populous? And it says, and then underscore tax base just moved out in the last 9 months. And, so what happens is that we have one state that is just continuing to raise taxes, raise taxes, raise taxes, and they're currently increasing the minimum wage again, because individuals can't live there, they can't pay the taxes. But what's happening is that the employers in the industry are moving out. And so there's about to be shortly a very horrible fiscal collapse that was precipitated under the guise of we're making it better to live in this state, and little realizing that they're literally cutting their own throat. They're bleeding themselves totally, totally dry. We do dumb things, and the correct people are not being held responsible. And when an argument to this effect was brought up before that governor just last year, people in the audience started jeering, and many of them were visitors from other countries that hadn't yet achieved their documentation. Yeah, so go ahead.
No, so I want to get some clarification here, and then I have one more thing, and then that'll be it for what I want to say. But I would appreciate your comments. So when you say that these people are there to serve the public trust and they have bonds in place and so forth and so on, and, you know, we really don't want somebody suing and taking the fire station and all that kind of thing, do you think that part of this is – I had a bad experience in the 80s where a corporation that I was involved with in the building was sued on an alleged slip and fall when, in fact, it could be proven that party dragged themselves on the property because it was a corporation in a commercial building, et cetera, et cetera. And they were ultimately paid, and they didn't go any further to try and take the property or whatever. So I've had my own experience with this kind of thing. Now, back then, I was told that, listen, you bought an insurance policy, and you basically contracted your rights away to allow the insurance company to make any decision that they wanted. So what I think I hear you saying, but I don't want to put words in your mouth or conclude that you're saying something that you're not. When you're talking about this fiduciary responsibility of government but being granted immunity, then I would guess in this commercial world that the insurance companies are actually a part of this, if we could look at this as some kind of conspiracy to deprive people of their rights. I mean, I don't see that somebody who drags themselves onto a piece of property when there's witnesses to this should be paid anything. And I don't care if it's paying them less than whatever it would cost to defend the action. So are you actually saying that this is all kind of like one big conspiracy and you buy an insurance policy, so you signed your rights away, you contracted your rights away, and that just happens to fit very nicely with the serving the public trust and making them immune?
You know, that's a very good point, Kent. Actually, the issue about and with the insurance company there is that the insurance company is offering you a service, and they're now co-defendants with you, and they have the right to, because they have a responsibility to pay, they also have the right to defend themselves. And in many certain cases, because another individual doesn't have the wherewithal to defend not just themselves, but the insurance company. The insurance company is the one that does the hiring of the attorneys. And so literally, it may seem like a conspiracy when in certain cases, it's just an economic pursuit. They're trying to keep their losses to a minimum. So, yeah, they do want to take over the litigation, and they want to bring in the heavy hitters, and they want to end it as quick as possible. And some of them, they'd like to end out of court. And to that end, they do make sometimes concessions that sweep away an individual's rights. But they have justiciable standing to plead their own case, because the individual that paid the $900 for the $1 million indemnity policy only has $900 worth of skin in the game. They've got $1 million worth of skin in the game. So to that end, they're going to want to defend it to $1 million worth. And when your 900 doesn't even equal 1,000 or 1/100th of what the skin they've got in the game, sometimes they appear to be callous and insensitive towards you, and that can appear to be a conspiracy.
So I'm mischaracterizing this as a conspiracy when in fact they have more skin in the game. So it's an economic decision.
I would have to agree with your observation on that.
Okay, thank you. And the last thing I wanted to
No. Hey, wait a minute, please. We've had 6 people with their hand raised. We're almost approaching 50 minutes on one student's questions, series of questions. What I'd like to do, and please understand, I super value your questions, Kent, but I think we have a kind of a rule of order that we could make here, that when anyone raises their hand, they're entitled to a question and all the follow-up questions pertaining to that question to thresh that question out, fine. But then once they've asked that question, then let's move on and take them off with their hands raised and let them press star 2 again so they can come in underneath the bottom of the list and let everybody else get their questions. We had, of the 6 people that had their hand raised, 5 of them have taken their hand down and only one remains. So let's get Ron's question here up here and let him get that threshed out and then come back to Kent for that last question. Is that all right, Kent?
That's okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Okay.
Kent,
thank you.
Very much value your questions.
Yeah, absolutely.
Keep them coming, brother.
Yeah, please do.
You're the man.
We just compared to all the other callers.
Let's give some other people a chance.
Yeah, exactly. Ron, go ahead.
Yes. Comment on your ownership of property. When you're born, you bring in the opportunity of labor and the thought process, and when you die, you take that with you. Everything else is compromise and equity, what you can get for what you've got. Do you concur?
That's that is a very good way to look at it, Ron. There's an old saying that says, no man can be considered unwise giving up what he can't keep for that which can never be taken away. And that is so true. And to that end, there's also other ways to convert short-term wealth into long-term wealth. But and your statement seems very correct.
Compensation for equity.
Yeah. Well, may I put that into an eternal perspective?
Sure.
There's a word in the scriptures that says, who has given up houses, riches, inheritance, gold, silver, family, friends, or loved ones that will they not be rewarded tenfold in the life to come? Or he who gives to the poor lends to the Lord and surely won't lose their reward. Anyone who gives one such as this just a cool drink of water in my name surely won't lose his reward. All of those are taking what we have down here and turning it into long-term wealth, isn't it? And a long-term comfortable adventures, aren't they?
Yes, I agree.
Did you have any other question, Ron?
Yes, next point of fact. In the rural community, there have been many farmers who have passed away, and the government came in presented a death tax. They did not have sufficient funds to pay the death tax, so they had to sell everything. When they sold everything, they got taxed on income and then had to pay the death tax. So they were taxed 2 and 3 times.
Okay. What state do you live in, Ron?
Right now I live in Florida. I used to live in Illinois.
Okay. Are you come from an agricultural family or a background?
Yes, I do.
Would you raise animals or grains and cereals?
Both. I was running 2,000 head of hogs a year, plus 400
okay.
acres of corn, beans, and wheat.
Okay. Wow. So you had almost over three quarters of a section.
Yes. Well,
okay.
I had fiduciary of that. I only owned a portion of it. I rented on a crop share other properties.
Yeah, I know what that's like. My family had been renting 9 quarters out for friends and others that were farming close by, and then finally just sold them off to pay for my parents' medical bills just recently. But they, I hadn't heard of a death tax. I am very interested in hearing more about that. Did I understand that it's a DEATH tax?
Probate would be equivalent to.
Okay, you're calling. Okay, probate is the death tax. Okay, I have had experiences with probate where the state's assessor says, "Well, you know, there's this and there's that," and they were just flat out told, "Here." Here's the assets. No, you sell them. No. Here's the assets, because if we sell them, you're gonna tax it there. And it says, and here's what happened. They says, you know what? And they wrote off the debt due every single time. They told them, here's the combines. You know what an 8230 is, right?
Yes.
The old green and gold. It my uncle had four of them, and they were demanding, this is North Dakota, they were demanding that the probate tax be told. My cousin just says, look, here's the titles. You guys go sell them. You take care of it, because they knew that was coming, that it was actually – in the county where they were at, and it was a little town called Foreman in North Dakota, it would have accounted to three layers of taxation, because it was not just the probate, not just the income, but the sales tax. the local sales tax they would have had to pay. So it was within three layers of taxation to sell them. And they just told the state, here, you take them, you sell them. Here's what they're valued at. There's, you know, we still have notes out on three of them, but here's what the equity is. And, it was 2.5, almost 3 weeks later, they came back to my cousin and he says, no, 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 you just go ahead and keep it. He says, nope. He says, you put that in writing. That, if you're going to say, you know, if you're going to say my Uncle Jerome's taxes are resolved, my dad's taxes are resolved, then that's it. You put it in writing now. And they said, no, I don't put anything in writing. He says, then you're technically committing fraud, and the county sheriff is already on his way out here. He says, you can't do that. I'm a state. He says, county sheriff. He says, I've got everything recorded right here. You put it in writing. Otherwise, we're, you know, and he saw the county sheriff's SUV coming, you know, out there. You know, there's, you know, those old roads are kind of dusty. You could see his, and apparently the guy hand wrote it. And he says, now we're going to go in town to the bank and get it notarized. And by the time the sheriff got there, they were getting ready to head out. He explained everything to him. And he says, well, sheriff, can you take, he says, no. He says, and he played back his little iPhone recording of it. He says, no, you're going into town and getting that notarized right now. But he says, but the bank's already closed. It closed half an hour ago. He says, no, we'll make sure we stop by, you know, the clerk's house and get that notarized right now. Otherwise, you're staying in town tonight, you know. And but, yeah, they, there are people that don't know, that aren't near as bright as you are, Ron, that don't see that coming, that triple taxation. And, yeah, they get frocked with it, and they don't even realize it even after the fact why they didn't end up with something out of their parents' passing. You know, because they didn't do the math. I'm glad to hear that you're aware of that. And it sounds like, you may even have a day or two on, us 50 models. You know.
One or two,
huh? Yeah. Well, I appreciate your wisdom and your thoughts there, my honored brother.
I'd be double digits, 77.
Oh boy. Sick'em doggy.
Twice perfected. Twice perfected.
Yeah, you're a 40s model. You know, I have an adopted aunt that, in June should be 103. But the Father's grace strikes again in spite of us. Do you have any other questions, Ron?
Yes. Well, I have a follow up to the last statement. An alternative feature would be to put everything in trust. You be the trustee, or your corporate soul be the trustee, and you own nothing, but you control everything, just like Kennedy, only you do it legally and ahead of time.
You know what? I wish I would have thought of that. You rocked.
All righty.
No.
All right.
I yield.
Next is Tom Anderson. Go ahead, Tom.
Hey, guys. How are we doing?
Tom.
Good.
Great. Right. Highly honored to see Mr. Anderson. Thomas, how are you? Has the snow started to melt up there yet? Hello?
Tom?
I've been lost for a long time. I hit my mute button. No, we can't see if the snow's leaving. We can't get our doors open.
Say it again?
I said, no, I can't tell you if the snow is leaving. We can't get our doors open. There's so much snow.
Oh. Yeah.
We had sunshine today. We've been blessed. Lord's good. So are we on for tomorrow?
Yes, we are.
Do you have an idea of a time? I've got some doctor's appointments with the wife and her concussion here.
What's your schedule like tomorrow?
Well, morning or before probably quarter after nine would be fine if we could do it early in the morning or middle of the day then.
Okay, let me look real quick here.
Middle of the day would be better for me.
Okay.
Yeah, originally we had you for 10.
Yeah.
What time would be best for you? Now, is that still a good idea, Michael, at 10 o'clock, or what would be better?
Well, no, we got a doctor's at 10. I got to get my wife a doctor at 10, so it would have to be before 9 or after quarter to 11.
Yeah, sometime afternoon, please.
Okay, let's – Now, Tom, you're in Central Time, right?
That is correct.
Okay, so Michael, if we went to 12 Central, 1 o'clock Eastern, would that work for you?
That'd be great.
Yes, sir.
So that works for both of you?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep.
Yes,
right.
Thank
Sounds
you,
good.
Tom.
Okay, thanks, guys. Good talk. Thanks.
Okay,
well,
I appreciate that.
I need you to initiate the call, Tom.
Gotcha. I'll do that. 12 o'clock, I'll call you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye.
All right. Back
okay.
to Kent. Go ahead, Kent.
Okay, Mike, you sure you don't want to invite the other people that put their hands down because my conversation was so lengthy with John to put their hands up and entertain their questions before you entertain my
last
one?
I wouldn't say 50 minutes was hogging the phone. No, I wouldn't say that at all.
Okay.
No, listen, they know to press star two. Let's just wrap up with your last question. I've got to get to bed.
Okay. So, John, you were talking a little while ago. You were saying about how important it is to get back to the common law. Bernie, when he speaks, is quite adamant about the fact that his ecclesiastical trust is not a common law trust, and that when it comes to corporate souls, he's only done one that you could classify as common law. The rest of them are basically statutory under some state law, presently Montana, previously Wyoming, for example. So could you just, in short form, elaborate on what you were saying so that there's a clear understanding here of what is common law and when it's appropriate for that based on what you've been saying and going back to that versus the ownership of property and the holding of properties in entities that cannot be called common law entities.
Okay. Common law was always based on how your fellow person was treated or not treated, meaning that to have justiciable standing to complain, you had to have been injured, meaning that something happened to you that was wrong. There was no such thing as a victimless crime. You know, the fact that he stepped outside and smoked a cigarette in a no-smoking zone, there's no injured party. There's nobody left with a disability because of what he did. There cannot be a crime under common law. And coincidentally, under common law, you can't sue somebody for their assets or their property unless you are an injured party with justiciable standing and are willing to file a verified complaint. And so under statutory law, there's all kinds of sites, statutes, etc., that an individual can be convicted on, and the classic example is somebody making a California stop at a stop sign, you know, or turning right on red, you know, without coming to a complete stop.
So you're differentiating. So clear that up. You're differentiating between a malprohibitive crime and a malinse crime.
Okay, you kind of faded out for a moment there on the restatement
again,
please.
I said, to be clear, you're drawing a distinction between a malleta prohibitive crime and a malleta in se crime. Is that a fair analogy?
Yes, it is. Meaning that unless there's somebody, an injured party, there's been no crime. So if you were to walk across Mrs. Jones' lawn, unless you disturbed the chickens in the back or, you know, left footprints in the front yard, technically there hasn't been a crime. You know, it says don't walk on the grass, you know, in the park. The park is a public. Now, and here's going to come a distinction in just a moment. But you walk across the grass, it says don't walk across the grass, and you leave footprints, or you disturb the animals in the public zoo there, then now you've committed a crime. But Mrs. Jones' yard, you know, you didn't bend a blade of grass and you didn't disturb the chickens in the back. Most people would say there's not a crime, except that if she says it's posted no trespassing, that is the one time that is one of the few times in common law where it is no longer, you know, you can prosecute a victimless crime. And in this case, the crime is you created a perceived threat to Mrs. Jones' safety and security. It's posted no trespassing. She's afraid, you know, for her person. She's only 5'1" and a half and weighs 93 pounds when she's soaking wet and just fell in, you know, the pool out back, you know, and she's scared kittenless of anybody that's over 5'5", you know, let alone a 6'1" male. And she works very hard on her front lawn. You know, she's dichondra. And she doesn't want any footprints in there because, you know, anybody who's ever built or planted a dichondra lawn knows that that's one of the hardest lawns to maintain. Well, for her, she extra work. So for her, for posted no trespassing does constitute a crime because in a roundabout way, she was actually injured. But the argument initially is that there's no injury there. But in common law, there's always an injured party.
Okay. So is it safe to say that Bernie's corporation soul is statutory in nature, but is CRT?
No.
Okay. Clarify.
Keep going.
Okay. But is CRT is not a common law trust?
Okay. There are statutes that recognize ecclesiastical law that it is governed by godly statutes. And technically a republic, whether most people are willing, anybody's willing to acknowledge it or not, is an ecclesiastical entity. It's a government based on rules established by God himself. And that's what a republic is. Democracy is ruled by community or majority rule, or some people like to use the term mob rule. And to that end, when you have mob rule, you have statutes that, and while the republic in most cases relies upon some form of written law to recognize and identify that this one is governed by godly law or ecclesiastical law, sometimes in the charitable religious trust, there are certain places in there, especially with and Justice Breshears is much more literate with this than I am. But what happens is that to make a place that meets people's understanding and expectation in the existing law, the charitable religious trust bridges some gaps there that that the corp soul doesn't have. Okay, and that's as simple as I can put it.
Okay, so Mike, when you said,
Kent, I've got a question. I've got a question for you that should clear up your question.
Okay.
Okay? What is the difference? You're the judge. What is it, or I'm in a court, I'm pleading something. What is the difference between me saying I'm charging this law enforcement officer with Title 42, Section 1983? What's the difference between saying that and then saying to an Article 7 court, I'm charging this law enforcement officer with deprivation of rights under color of law? What's the difference?
Well, the net effect could be the same. First one being statutory, second coming from the point of an American national.
Well, okay. Let me ask you a question. Which is one of those civil and one of those criminal?
Well, Title 18, 241. John, the point that I'm making is that what you, and I'm supporting what you had said earlier, and that is this: you have law that is American common law, such as quote deprivation of rights under color of law, end quote, and then this other group over here in another country, for that matter, have created something they call statutes, as Title 42, Section 1983, or Title 18, Section 242, whichever it is, civil or criminal, but they have put these in different boxes under things they call statutes in their jurisdiction. And that's the point that I was trying to support what you had said earlier and what that difference was.
Did that make sense to you, Chet?
Well, only partially. I want Mike to clear up why he said no when I asked about the corporate soul or made the statement that the corporate soul is statutory in nature.
Well, John answered that because the corporation soul is actually under ecclesiastical law. It's a separate jurisdiction entirely. It has nothing to do with the statutes. However, that country over there has something that they've recognized within their statutes. Totally different.
You know, Michael, okay. I think there's a discrete point that we might want to bring out. And that's that, the ecclesiastical law, until there was a statutory recognition of it, many states were ignoring it. And to that end, something that Justice Breshears has commented on is that there is a statutory, because so many people recognize that ecclesiastical law is not just a law, but a very strong law, that the ungodly were blowing past it, so that they established a statutory recognition of it. And I think your discernment of what the difference between statutory recognition and statutory are may not be quite the same. In this case, it took a statutory recognition of it so that other people will understand that it's out there and that it is viable, and there is a responsibility to it. Without that statutory recognition, a lot of people say, well, that's a lot of hoofba, and I can start my own little religious club here, make my laws, and you're saying that I can run the country on them? Well,
here's your example. Florida, 1903, 1905, something like that. Florida has no statutes recognizing corporation soul, none. But in 1903, but in 1903 or 1905, they ruled on one of the greatest decisions regarding a corporation soul, in recognizing that the corporation soul is the man, and the man is the corporation soul as the manager. And there's no statute that Florida has anywhere on the books regarding this. But they recognized it as American ecclesiastical law. That's a good question to bring up to Bernie on Saturday.
Okay. I want to think about your responses a little longer.
Sure.
I appreciate you delving into the question, though, and providing the answer. The last thing I want to say to John, I think he'll appreciate this. Last night I mentioned that I was sleeping over. I know that you know Dr. Sandra Michael from a prior conversation we had in Las Vegas. And last night I slept over in one of her 24-unit centers, and I'll be doing the same tomorrow night. That'll be the third night inside of a week, and we'll see what transpires from that. But again, I know you know her, and I thought you'd be interested in that.
Yeah, we may have some clue. Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right.
Kate, do we have anybody else?
Oh, no, sir. It's time to go to bed. Night-night.
That's a good thing. I've still got a teeny bit of work to do tonight.
I have a doctor's appointment early in the morning.
Yeah. With that, the Father's blessings be upon everyone. Good evening.
Good evening, and thank you, John. Good evening, everybody. We'll see you tomorrow night, prayerfully, with Mr. Slevin, and to learn and understand how his LLC can make everything nice, everything bright. Until then, good night, everybody, and be well.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID, followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted. Thank you.